5 was Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. Russia and Turkey have embarked on closer trade and energy ties following a meeting Tuesday in St. Petersburg between the country's two leaders, Vladimir Putin and Recep Tayyip Erdogan. The Turkish leaders said both sides are determined to restore relations and improve them. He said the two countries will restore their yearly trade target of $100 billion and speed up the resumption of charter flights. They pledged to build a natural gas pipeline and negotiate Turkey's first nuclear power plant. Bilateral ties with Moscow were strained after Turkey shot down a Russian warplane last November along the Syrian border. Mr. Erdogan has accused Turkish cleric Fethullah Gulen, exiled in the U.S., of orchestrating last month's attempted coup. Tuesday, Turkey's justice minister warned of rising anti-Americanism if Gulen is not handed over. Elizabeth Trudeau is a U.S. spokesperson.
The extradition process is a very technical, it's legally governed. You know, this is not a process that is influenced by emotion or political rhetoric. It's actually governed by a treaty.
Asked if the Erdogan visit to Russia hurts American interests, Trudeau said the visit is not viewed as a zero-sum game in bilateral relations. She said those ties with Turkey are strong. Sudanese rebel groups said Tuesday they signed an African Union-brokered roadmap to reach a ceasefire in separate long-running conflicts. Fighting has persisted between the Sudanese army and rebels in the southern regions of Kordofan and Blue Nile State since 2011. Conflict in Darfur has raged since 2003. The accord is aimed at reaching a permanent ceasefire, a national dialogue, and immediate humanitarian assistance. This is VOA News. The United Nations Tuesday warned that more than 2 million people in the Syrian city Aleppo have no access to running water or electricity, and have called for a halt to the fighting to repair damaged infrastructure and deliver aid. Jens Lerke of the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs said the number of displaced people is on the rise.
The situation in Aleppo, as we all know, has been extremely difficult. We have seen new displacement into western Aleppo. UNICEF recently, and it was mentioned here, talked about 25,000 people who came in. I was told this morning that an additional 10,000 IDPs have been registered. There may be many more.
UN agencies have called for weekly 48-hour humanitarian pauses in fighting to provide desperately needed aid to residents and to evacuate them. The United States says it's approved the potential sale of more than 130 battle tanks, armored vehicles, and other equipment to Saudi Arabia worth more than $1 billion. U.S. lawmakers will have 30 days to block the deal. The announcement comes as a Saudi-led coalition resumed airstrikes on Yemen's rebel-held capital Sana'a Tuesday, killing at least 14 people. The strikes come after a three-month pause for UN-sponsored peace talks, which ended with no agreement in Kuwait. Funerals were held Tuesday for more than 70 victims of Monday's suicide blast at a Quetta, Pakistan hospital that targeted mostly lawyers gathered to mourn the death of a colleague. More than 100 others were wounded. An Islamist group, Jamaat-ur-Ahrar, an offshoot of Pakistan Taliban and with possible links to Islamic State, claimed responsibility. A candlelight vigil was held Tuesday in Karachi, attended by the head of the city's bar association, Haq Nawaz Talpur.
We demand from the government that the terrorist should be eliminated from our country as soon as possible. And those person who is responsible for it, bring to the justice, and they should be hanged.
Pakistani lawyers boycotted the country's courts Tuesday and staged rallies in several cities. Officials in Afghanistan's southern Helmand province warn the Taliban is tightening its grip around Lashkar-Gah, the regional capital, with one provincial council chief warning that without help from Kabul, the province will collapse. Fierce fighting has forced thousands to flee to the city. The first U.S. ambassador to Somalia in 25 years arrived in Mogadishu Tuesday. Ambassador Stephen Schwartz tasked with helping Somali officials stabilize the country after decades of civil war and an al-Shabaab insurgency. Meanwhile, Somali leaders endorsed a new timetable setting October 30 as the date for a presidential election. During Day 4 action at the Rio Summer Olympics, American swimmer Michael Phelps captured two more gold medals with victories in the 4x200-meter freestyle relay earlier in the 200-meter butterfly. He now boasts an unprecedented 21 gold medals. I'm Victor Beatty.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm William Eagle in Washington, filling in for James Butte, who's on vacation until next week. Today is Wednesday, August 10th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Stephen Ellis of the International Press Institute says there are political reasons behind the Zambian government's closure of the Post newspaper.
Our findings are that the case that the government has advanced against this opposition newspaper do not appear to be based on taxes, as the government has said.
Carter Roberts of the World Wildlife Fund says he's optimistic that the demand for ivory can be stopped.
You've seen people's minds change about diamonds, about fur, and I believe that we can change the way people look at these products too.
In other stories, Nigeria takes steps to protect civilians in case of flooding along the Niger River. In Cameroon, hotels and restaurants prepare for the Women's Football Cup of Nations competition in November, and the Clinton Global Initiative is working to save one of the planet's most majestic beasts, the African elephant. The International Press Institute has expressed concern about press freedom in Zambia. This as the Southern African country goes to the polls in the upcoming August 11th general elections and referendum. In a newly released report, the International Press Institute says the government in Lusaka used its influence to enable the Zambia Revenue Authority to shut down production of the Post newspaper and seize its offices. The government denies the allegations. For more on the report, Peter Cloti reached Stephen Ellis, the Director of Advocacy and Communications at the International Press Institute.
Our findings are that the case that the government has advanced against this opposition newspaper do not appear to be based on taxes, as the government has said. Instead, the paper has suffered not only the seizure of its most vital assets, but those who are helping it to continue printing have faced harassment, and other media outlets that have similar debts are not subject to the same sort of collection activity by the government. Coming in an environment where there's been a number of incidents of pressure on other media outlets in the last year, and where we've seen a sharp uptick in political violence, it left us extremely concerned about the state of democracy in Zambia and what this might mean for the future.
Well, Stephen, officials of the administration that I spoke to said, why wouldn't the Post publishers just pay their taxes just like any other businesses? Why not settle that debt and then continue publishing?
They want to. We spoke with the Post, and we also spoke with representatives of the government who made that argument. Right now, the Post cannot actually access its bank accounts because they're frozen. So even if it decided that it wanted today to pay off the full debt, it couldn't do that because the Zambian Revenue Authority will not even sit down and talk to it. There's a court order by the Tax Appeals Tribunal directing the government to give back the premises and directing the Post to make at least partial payment right now on what it actually believes it owes, and to turn over security for the entire amount in order to guarantee that it will be paid while the Revenue Appeals or the Tax Appeals Tribunal considers the matter. Unfortunately, the Revenue Authority will not sit down with the Post. The Post isn't able to actually make any payments. And it's most important to note that the Post doesn't deny that it might owe some taxes. It's just that it disputes the amount. It feels that what the Revenue Authority has levied, the amount, is incorrect.
Well, the situation is that the government has denied some findings that there were political machinations in this just to undermine the newspaper because it's been critical of some of its activities. Why is there an insistence that there are all kinds of political calculations by the government to undermine the paper?
It's just the totality of the circumstances. The fact that they refuse to sit down and work with the Post to work out the tax issue, to arrive at a correct amount, to allow the Post to pay. The fact that the government has been pressuring anyone else who attempts to give support to the Post, especially those who have printed it while this shutdown is ongoing, and the fact that the government does not take similar measures against other media outlets that owe similar debts.
Supporters of the government of the Patriotic Front Party, the ruling party, has said that those organizations or individuals are helping the Post newspaper barred from printing to go ahead and print and circulate are aiding and abetting criminality and undermining the laws of Zambia. What do you say to that?
I say that sounds somewhat ridiculous. There's no court order preventing the Post from publishing. And to the extent that the government has advanced any justification for this case, is that the Post needs to pay taxes. It's never said that the Post is engaging in illegal activities as far as publishing. It's never maintained that the Post presents some sort of threat to public order.
That was Stephen Ellis, the Director of Advocacy and Communications at the International Press Institute. He was speaking with Peter Cloti from the Austrian capital, Vienna. Nigeria's National Emergency Management Agency is warning of massive flooding along the Niger River as a result of excessive rains. It is asking people likely to be affected to evacuate to higher ground. The river flows through much of Nigeria from the north-central region to the Niger Delta in the south. It usually experiences excessive swelling during the rainy season, often with destructive effects. Reporter Paula Kolo in Abuja gave me an update on the situation.
The floods are expected to come in any time from now. The rains have picked up pace in the last couple of weeks, and it's expected to flood the areas that border the River Niger and the main tributary, which is River Benue. And these areas will affect at least 11 states, coming from northwest down to the central Kogi state and Nasarawa, which are very close to Abuja, the seat of government. And it will just go down like that to the Niger Delta area, where there are several tributaries of the River Niger and, of course, the creeks. These areas are usually prone to flooding at the time when the River Niger gets swollen up with the water coming from the source, which is in Mali, and from there to the Niger Republic before it gets to Nigeria.
What measures are authorities taking to try to avert a disaster?
The National Emergency Management Agency is being proactive this time around, having learned a few lessons from the most serious case in the last 40 years or so, which occurred in 2012. What they've done this time is to issue alerts to all the areas that are likely to experience this flooding. They've also identified safe areas where people could be evacuated to and take shelter for the period when the usual domains will be experiencing this excessive flooding. So they are giving early warnings to state governments and local governments. They are asking them to prepare grounds, to clear drains so that water can flow. They are asking them to also take other preemptive measures to mitigate the effect of the flooding.
And what is the likely impact on the economy if there is severe flooding?
It's usually very serious. The 2012 flooding took about 300 lives. Farmlands were lost, and a lot of public buildings, hospitals, homes, schools were damaged in those areas. So it's likely to repeat again itself this time around. And farmlands may also be affected. Agricultural produce may be lost. And this always runs into billions of naira, hundreds of millions of dollars, if you like. And it's usually catastrophic at a time of serious economic recession like Nigeria is facing right now. And there's the security situation in the northeast has reduced the amount of area that is used for farming, and there is some food shortage in some parts of the country as a result. And so if the flooding were to damage crops and farmland again, it may just exacerbate an already bad situation. There is inflation already. Price of food items may go up, and poverty is likely to be worsened, as well as desperate situation that many ordinary people have found themselves in right now.
That was reporter Paula Kolo in Abuja. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm William Eagle in Washington. Today is Wednesday, August 10th. Please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. You can also call us in the United States at 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us a message. Ahead on our program, our listener of the day. A U.S. company with operations in Kenya called Burn Manufacturing is helping improve the lives of thousands of East Africans with an efficient charcoal-burning cook stove. The so-called saving stove, known as Jikokoa in Swahili, consumes less than half the charcoal of its competitors. It's also healthier. The World Health Organization says exposure to indoor air pollution caused by cooking on open fires leads to over 4 million deaths per year. The stove is also creating jobs and helping to conserve natural forests. Boston Nair is the general manager of Burn Manufacturing in Kenya. VOA's Ruben Chama asked him when and how the company got into the cook stove industry.
Our founder, Peter Scott, has been working on clean cook stoves for about 17 to 20 years in sub-Saharan Africa. And Burn was founded in 2011, but we only started manufacturing in Kenya in August 2013. And so we spent 2 years raising money, developing the product, developing a team. And so we've only been manufacturing in Kenya for about 2.5 years.
How did your company get interested in making stoves for Africa?
Again, it was back to Peter Scott, our founder. And the reason why he was interested in clean burning cook stoves in Africa was the pressure on the forests in Africa. The population is booming and cities are developing quickly, but there isn't a big growth in cooking technologies. And there isn't a huge growth in, say, gas, LPG. There's more people in the cities, and at the same time, the forests are going the other way. That's why we did it from a high level. But again, if you look at a household in Kenya or East Africa or Sub-Saharan Africa, especially in an urban setting, you might be spending 30% or 50% of your income on charcoal for cooking, for example. So you can look at it. It's you talk about poverty, but one of the reasons why people can't, you know, continue to improve their livelihoods is because they're spending all their money on fuel for cooking. So not only you have forests from the global perspective, but you have people's pocket, and at the household level, you can have a big impact.
There have been many types of cook stoves introduced into Africa in recent years. What makes this particular one different?
So the difference with the Jikokoa is that it's almost designed by consumers. So many products are designed in Europe or designed in the US in a lab, and then somebody just makes it in China and sends it to Kenya. We have the exact opposite approach, where we design everything in Kenya with Kenyan women and Kenyan households so that it meets exactly their needs. And then we manufacture it right here. And so instead of having our design or product development in the Western world somewhere and then made in China, and then just send it to Kenya like everybody's supposed to like it here, we center everything right here to make sure we get it right. So our products are, not only do they save fuel, but they also save you time, and they're more usable.
In Kenya, where has it been tested, and what have been the results?
We have more than 140,000 customers in Kenya, and we have customers in every single county in Kenya, even Isiolo or whichever county, wherever. And so it's been tested all over the country, mostly in urban settings. And people are saving 60% of the fuel, which means 60% of the money they were spending on charcoal for cooking.
How much does the cook stove cost, and where can one buy?
Right now, the cook stove costs $3,800. You can buy it at any of the major supermarkets, Nivus, Tuskegee's, Nakumatt. You can also buy from M-Copa, or you can go to your local SACO and ask them if you can purchase through their SACO.
From here, what are your next steps?
So we have a wood-burning Jiko coming on later this year that'll be available to the rural communities in Kenya and East Africa. And then we're expanding to the other countries in East Africa, namely Uganda and Tanzania, significantly this year. And then we're looking at West Africa to start a new manufacturing hub and service all of ECOWAS.
That was Boston Nyer, the Kenya-based general manager of Burn Manufacturing, the maker of fuel-efficient, clean-burning cook stoves, speaking to VOA's Ruben Chama in Nairobi. The Clinton Global Initiative is working with conservation groups and African governments to step up efforts to save one of the planet's most majestic beasts, the African elephant, which is critically endangered. In 2012 alone, over 35,000 were killed by poachers for their ivory tusks. VOA's Adam Phillips reports.
At a news conference in New York, John Calvelli of the Wildlife Conservation Society outlined the consortium's three-pronged $80 million strategy.
In brief, to stop the killing, funds will be used to support national governments to scale up anti-poaching enforcement at 50 priority elephant sites, including hiring and supporting an additional 3,100 park guards. To stop the trafficking, anti-trafficking efforts will be increased by strengthening intelligence networks and penalties for violations and adding training and sniffer dog teams at 10 key transit points. Stop the demand. New demand reduction efforts will be implemented in 10 consumer markets over the next 3 years.
The challenge of catching poachers in the act of killing elephants is complicated by a lack of proper funding for rangers, who sometimes get more money from bribes to ignore the law than they do from local governments to enforce it. Much of their equipment is broken or outdated. Elizabeth Bennett, also of the Wildlife Conservation Society, says the consortium's funds will increase salaries and pay for new technology, like GPS units for the rangers.
And when they're going around, they record what poaching signs they see, they record what elephant signs they see, what other signs of any problems that they might see, and then that all gets fed into a central database to say where the real problems are and therefore where the enforcement effort needs to be.
When many people think of poachers, they imagine a lone villager heading out into the bush looking to make a quick kill for easy money. But Patrick Bergen of the African Wildlife Foundation says going after the little guy has limited results.
We need to go higher up the food chain to stop the trafficking. There are people commissioning this and trading it. These are criminal gangs. This is international crime, and this is organized crime.
And fighting that, says Bergen, requires a range of national legislation that may not necessarily be related to poaching.
Immigration charges, arms charges, money laundering charges, movement of goods over border charges, and they can confiscate bank accounts, houses, aircraft. I'm allowing someone to charter a helicopter from me. They seem a little shady, but they pay cash. I'm going to let it go. No, your helicopter may not be coming back.
Carter Roberts, president of the World Wildlife Fund, says stopping the demand for ivory is also essential.
You've seen people's minds change about diamonds, about fur, and I believe that we can change the way people look at these products too.
Jane Goodall, the British anthropologist best known for her pioneering work with chimpanzees, has also spent time with wild elephant herds. She told the news conference that compassion, not just policy, is also critical to ending the slaughter.
If you once watch young elephants playing, splashing each other, having fun in the water, then you realize that, like so many other creatures, they have emotions similar to ours, then you realize that this is causing unbearable suffering to some very amazing animals with whom we share or should be sharing this planet.
Organizers of the initiative recognize that it will take more than marquee names, conservation groups, and money to end the ivory trade. African governments must work with local communities to recognize that it is in their economic and moral interest to protect the world's largest land mammal living in their midst. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
Cameroonian cuisine is generally touted as one of Africa's most varied, thanks to the country's diverse ethnicity, colonial influence, and its geographical setting at the intersection of West and Central Africa. A few months from now, in November, the country will host the Continental Women's Football Cup of Nations competition, and thousands of visitors will have a chance to sample the country's dishes. From the country's largest urban settlement, Douala, Enterique Divine Jr. reports.
I have come to a restaurant in downtown Douala specializing in African dishes. showcased on the menu outside, and amid a mouth-watering fragrance of spicy aromas are several Cameroonian foods. They include fufu corn, a maize-based couscous served with vegetables and meat, achu, boiled and pounded cocoyam molded into the shape of a volcanic crater that holds a yellowish soup, bongo chubby, a thick blackish sauce loaded with slices of smoked or simmered fish served with cassava or rice. And then there is ndole, the country's national dish comprising a zesty stew made from bitter leaf greens, peanut paste, meat or pork, and shrimps. Yet, experts say Cameroonian cuisine continues to lag behind international standards. Pascal Tufak, an official in charge of promoting Cameroon as a tourist destination, says there is an urgent need to reorganize the country's cookery industry.
Nous devons de plus en plus organiser notre cuisine, à ce qu'elle devienne la cuisine des Camerounais.
He says within the context of globalization, there is an urgent need to modify some popular Cameroonian dishes.
De la cuisine camerounaise qui est faite au standard.
The country is preparing to host the 2016 African Women's Championship, the continent's biggest women's soccer congregation, in November and December. To meet that challenge, the Ministry of Tourism has launched a nationwide campaign to groom hotel and restaurant cooks to embrace and uphold international standards. Bertrand Ndogmo is a restaurant chief cook in Douala.
Le manque de professionnalisme. Vous voyez dans les hôtels qui préparent, qui font la cuisine.
He says there's a clear lack of professionalism in the sector, with hotel cooks and kitchens showing little or no respect for culinary security norms. And that's not all. Adeline Jimgang is chef at a popular hotel in Yaoundé.
When I see various hotels in Cameroon, I can say we are very far from universal standard. Because the condition in which we work is not it. It's not really what we learn in school. Even hygiene is not respected. Hotels in Cameroon don't have modern equipment. Yes, they lack modern equipment. And people, most of the cooks are not trained. Yes, I'm sure there will be. There will, since
among the country's culinary specialists, however, there is budding hope new sanitary standards will ensure that all visitors enjoy Cameroon's cuisine and their stay in the country. According to the Ministry of Tourism, Cameroon attracts over 1 million tourists annually, a figure set to swell when delegations from 8 participating countries begin arriving in Cameroon for the Women's Football Fiesta slated to span November 19 to December 3. For VOA News, I'm Tariq Devine Jr. in Douala, Cameroon.
The first U.S. ambassador to Somalia in 25 years has arrived in Mogadishu and presented his credentials to the Somali government. Ambassador Stephen Schwartz is tasked with helping Somali officials stabilize the country after decades of civil war and the al-Shabaab insurgency. A statement from the Somali Foreign Ministry said Schwartz praised the progress Somalia has made over the last 8 years and urged Somali leaders to deepen their commitment to improving the lives of the Somali people, including women and youth. That's it for this Wednesday, August 10th edition of Daybreak Africa. Join us again tomorrow for more Africa news and features. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm William Eagle in Washington, wishing you a peaceful Wednesday.
Next week on Straight Talk Africa, Shaka Sali and his guests discuss Zambia's general election set for August 11th. The office of the president and seats in the National Assembly are being contested. A constitutional referendum will be held with proposals to amend the nation's Bill of Rights. That's next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, Africa music fans. We have hours of the music that you love every day.
Some things change, some remain the same.
From the north to the south and the east to the west, we play only the best. Tune in at 0100-0200-1200-1300 UTC GMT right here on VOA Africa.